ethical issues? Robin said. He failed to keep the surprise out of his voice.
Yes, Colonel, ethical issues,
Matson said irritably.
Believe it or not.
I didn't mean to question your ethics, General, Robin said. Matson waved it away.
Forget it. The point stands. The Colonial Union has a long-standing law against cloning non-CDF personnel, alive or dead, but especially alive. The only time we clone humans is to stuff people back into unmodified bodies after their term of service is done. Bhutan is a civilian and a colonist. Even if we wanted to, we can't legally clone him.
Bhutan made a clone, Robin said.
If it's all the same, we won't let the morals of a traitor guide us in this, Colonel,
Matson said, irritated again. You could get a research dispensation from colonial law, Robin said. It's been done before. You've done it before.
Not for something like this, Matson said. We get dispensations when we test weapon systems on uninhabited planets. Start messing with clones, and some of the more reactionary types get a twitch in their skulls. Something like this wouldn't even get out of committee.
Bhutan's a key to whatever the IRA and their allies have planned, Robin said. This might be a time to take a page from the U.S. Marines and beg forgiveness rather than ask permission.
I admire your willingness to hoist the Jolly Roger, Colonel, Matson said. But you're not the one they'll shoot. We're not the only one.
Szilard, who had been chewing a steak, swallowed and set down his utensils.
We'll do it, he said.
Pardon?
Matson said.
Give the consciousness pattern to Special Forces, General, Szilard said, and give us Bhutan's genes. We'll use them to craft a Special Forces soldier. We use more than one set of genes to make every soldier. Technically, it won't be a clone. And if the consciousness doesn't take, it will make no difference. It'll just be another Special Forces soldier. There's nothing to lose.
Except that if the consciousness does take, we'll have a Special Forces soldier with treason on his mind, Matson said. That doesn't sound appealing.
We can prepare for that, Szilard said, and picked up his utensils again.
You'll be using genes from a live person and a colonist, Robin said. My understanding was that Special Forces only took the genes from CDF volunteers who die before they can serve. That's why they're called the Ghost Brigades.
Szilard looked up sharply at Robbins.
I don't much like that name, Szilard said. The genes of dead CDF volunteers are one component, and typically we use the volunteer genes as the template, but Special Forces has a wider latitude in the genetic material we're able to use to build our soldiers. Given our mission for the CDF is almost a requirement. Anyway, Bhutan is legally dead. We've got a dead body with his genes in them, and we don't know that he is alive.
Does he have any survivors?
No, Matson said. He had a wife and kid, but they died before he did. No other family.
Then there's no problem, Szilard said. After you're dead, your genes aren't yours anymore. We've used expired colonist genes before. I don't see why we can't do it again.
I don't remember hearing this about how you build your people's eye, Matson said.
We're quiet about what we do, General, Szilard said.
You know that.
He cut a piece of steak and speared it into his mouth. Robbins's stomach grumbled.
Matson grunted, leaned back in his chair, and looked up at Phoenix, imperceptibly turning in the sky.
Robbins followed his gaze and felt another pang of homesickness. Presently Matson turned his attention back to Szilard.
Bhutan is one of my people, he said. For better or worse, I can't pass the responsibility for this to you, Zai.
Fine, Szilard said, and nodded to Robbins.
Then let me borrow Robbins. He can act as your liaison, so military research will still have a hand in. We'll share information. We'll borrow the technician, too, Wilson. He can work with our technicians to integrate the Khonsu technology. If it works, we have Charles Bhutan's memories and motivations and a way to prepare for this war. If it doesn't work, I have another Special Forces soldier. Waste not, want not.
Matson looked over to Szilard, considering.
You seem eager to do this, Zai,
Matson said.
Humans are moving toward war with three species who have allied together, Szilard said. That's never happened before.
We could take on any one of them, but not all three at once. Special Forces have been told to stop this war before it starts. If this helps us to do that, we should do it.
Try it, at the very least.
Robbins, Matson said. Your thoughts?
If General Szilard is correct, then doing this would get around the legal and ethical issues, Robbins said. That makes it worth a shot, and we'll still be in the loop.
Robbins had his own personal set of worries about working with Special Forces technicians and soldiers, but it didn't seem the right time to air them. Matson, however, did not need to be so circumspect.
Your boys and girls don't play well with normal types, General, Matson said. That's one reason why military research and Special Forces research don't work together much.
Special Forces are soldiers, first and last, Szilard said. They'll follow orders. We'll make it work. We've done it before. We had a regular CDF soldier take part in Special Forces missions at the Battle of Coral. If we can make that work, we can get technicians to work together without undue bloodshed.
Matson tapped the table in front of him, pensively.
How long will this take? He asked.
We'll have to build a new template for this body, not just adapt previous genetics, Szilard said.
I'd need to double-check with my techs, but they usually take a month to build from scratch. After that, it takes 16 weeks minimum to grow a body, and then whatever time we need to develop the process to transfer the consciousness. We can do that and grow the body at the same time.
You can't make that go any faster, Matson said.
Well, we could make it go faster, Szilard said, but then you'd have a dead body, or worse.
You know you can't rush body manufacture. Your own soldiers' bodies are grown on the same schedule, and I think you remember what happens when you rush that.
Matson grimaced. Robbins, who had been Matson's liaison for only 18 months, was reminded that Matson had been at this job for a very long time. No matter their working relationship, there were still gaps in Robbins' knowledge of his boss.
Fine, Matson said. Take it. See if you can get anything out of it, but you watch him. I had my problems with Bhutan, but I never saw him as a traitor. He fooled me. He fooled everyone. You'll have Charles Bhutan's mind in one of your Special Forces bodies. God only knows what he could do with one of those.
Agreed, Szilard said. If the transfer is a success, we'll know it sooner than later. If it's not, I know where I can put him. Just to be sure.
Good,
Matson said, and looked up again at Phoenix, circling in sky.
Phoenix, he said,
watching the world twirl above him.
A reborn creature. Well, that's appropriate. A phoenix is supposed to rise up from the flames, you know. Let's just hope this reborn creature doesn't bring everything down in them.
They all stared at the planet above them. Chapter 3
This is it, Colonel Robbins said to Lieutenant Wilson as the body, encased in its creche, was wheeled into the decanting lab.
Oh, this is it, agreed Wilson, who moved over to a monitor that would momentarily display the body's vital signs.
Were you ever a father, Colonel?
No, Robbins said. My personal inclinations didn't run that way.
Well then, Wilson said, this is as close as you'll probably get.
Normally, the birthing lab would be filled with up to 16 Special Forces soldiers being decanted at once, soldiers who would be activated and trained together to build unit cohesion during training, and to ease the soldier's disorientation at being activated fully conscious but without any memory to speak of. This time, there was just one soldier, the one who would house Charles Bhutan's consciousness. It had been more than 2 centuries since the nascent colonial union, faced with its spectacular failure to defend the earliest of its colonies, the planet Phoenix was called so for a reason, realized that unmodified human soldiers were unable to get the job done. The spirit was willing. Human history recorded some of its greatest doomed battles in those years, with the Battle for Armstrong in particular studied as a masterful example of how to turn an imminent rout by alien forces into a shocking and painful Pyrrhic victory for one's enemy. But the flesh was all too weak. The enemy, all of the enemies, were too fast, too vicious, too pitiless, and too many. Human technology was good, and weapon to weapon, humans were as well equipped as the vast majority of their adversaries, but the weapon that ultimately matters is the one behind the trigger. The earliest modifications were relatively simple. increased speed, muscle mass, and strength, endurance. Early genetic engineers, however, were hampered by the practical and ethical problems of engineering humans in vitro, and then waiting for them to grow sufficiently large and smart enough to fight, a process that took roughly 18 years. The Colonial Defense Forces discovered, to its intense chagrin, that many of its relatively lightly genetically modified humans were not particularly pleased to discover they were raised as a crop of cannon fodder and refused to fight, despite the best indoctrination and propaganda efforts to persuade them otherwise. Unmodified humans were equally scandalized as the effort smacked of yet another eugenics effort on the part of a human government, and the track record of eugenics-loving governments in the human experience was not exactly stellar. The Colonial Union survived the racking waves of political crises that followed in the wake of its earliest attempts to genetically engineer its soldiers, but just barely. Had the battle for Armstrong not emphatically shown the colonies what sort of universe they were up against, the Union would likely have collapsed, and the human colonies would have been left in the position of competing against each other, as well as against every other intelligent species they had encountered to date. The Union was also saved by the near-simultaneous arrival of dual critical technological discoveries. The ability to force-grow a human body to adult size in months, and the emergence of the consciousness transfer protocol that allowed the personality and memories of one individual to be transported into another brain, provided that brain had the same genetics and had been adequately prepared with a series of pre-transfer procedures that developed some of the necessary bioelectrical pathways in the brain. These new technologies allowed the Colonial Union to develop a large alternate pool of potential recruits. The elderly, many of whom would readily accept a life in the military rather than die of old age, and whose deaths, in any event, would not create the multi-generational demographic damage that ensued when large numbers of healthy young adults were blown out of the gene pool at the end of an alien's weapon. Presented with this bountiful new pool of potential recruits, the Colonial Defense Forces found it had the luxury of making certain staffing choices. The CDF would no longer ask colonists to serve in the CDF. This had the salutary effect of allowing colonists to focus on developing their new worlds and making as many second-generation colonists as their planets could handle. It also eliminated a key source of political tension between the colonists and their government. Now that the young adults of the colonies were no longer extracted from their homes and families to die on battlefields trillions of miles away, the colonists were largely unconcerned with the ethical issues surrounding genetically modified soldiers, particularly ones who had, after all, volunteered to fight. In the stead of colonists, the CDF chose to select its recruits from the inhabitants of humanity's ancestral home, Earth. The Earth held billions of people. More people on that single globe, in fact, than existed on all the human colonies combined. The pool of potential recruits was enormous, so large that the CDF further limited its pool, choosing to take its recruits from comfortable and industrialized nations, whose economic circumstances allowed their citizens to survive well into their later years, and whose social blueprints created both an overemphasis on the desirability of youth and a parallel and profound national psychic discomfort with aging and death. These senior citizens were patterned by their societies to be excellent and eager recruits for the CDF. The CDF quickly discovered that these senior citizens would join up for a military tour even in the absence of detailed information about what such a tour entailed, and indeed, recruitment yields were higher the less the recruits knew. Recruits assumed military service in the CDF was like military service on Earth. The CDF was content to let the assumption stand. Recruiting seniors from industrialized nations proved so successful that the Colonial Union protected its recruiting pool by banning colonists from those nations, selecting its colonist pool from nations whose economic and social problems encouraged the more ambitious of its young people to get the hell out as soon as humanly possible. This division of military and colonist recruitment paid rich dividends for the Colonial Union in both areas. The military recruitment of senior citizens presented the CDF with one unexpected problem.
A fair number of recruits died before they could join the service, victims of heart attacks, strokes, and too many cheeseburgers, cheesecakes, and cheese curds.